corner yet. So I hope that that has been my contribution so far to the neighborhood, is that I've helped foster that, because that is definitely my goal.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how things develop, and maybe we'll check back in sometime in the next months or year or so.
Yeah,
thank you so much, Johnny Shaver, Jonathan Ogden, Brian Rose Schreiber. And this is Paul Rowan for Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Clean Water Act Turns 45. The celebration will be held on Wednesday, October 18th at 6 p.m. at the Laurelwood Public House and Brewery in Portland. The Clean Water Act has kept huge amounts of pollution out of our waterways and made significant progress towards the vision of fishable, drinkable, and swimmable waterways. Environment Oregon will be celebrating the Act's 45th anniversary with drinks, appetizers, and speakers. Again, that's the Clean Water Act Turns 45. Celebration on Wednesday, October 18th at 6 p.m. at the Laurelwood Public House and Brewery, 5115 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The last 6 weeks have seen an unprecedented number of climate change-related disasters, from multiple hurricanes slamming the Caribbean and the U.S. South to earthquakes in Mexico. Anarchists, anti-fascists, and anti-capitalists have been at the forefront of the disaster relief efforts. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, a special program focusing on Houston, Mexico, and Puerto Rico. I'll speak with Nisi X of the Black Women's Defense League in Texas, as well as anarchist organizer Scott Crow and activists organizing to send aid to Puerto Rico and Mexico.
People put aside their politics. They put aside what they think it should be, because when a disaster opens up us, our hearts, our emergency hearts to humanity, it actually shows who we really are.
That's this Friday from 11 a.m. to noon on KBOO.
And good morning. This is KBOO Portland. And the time is 9:01. And here's what we have coming up for you for the remainder of the morning. First, on Political Perspectives, we will hear a segment from Making Contact featuring their community storytelling fellow at Vincent Medina. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia comes your way. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, it's the Food Show, today hosting dietitian Melinda Hemmelgarn, connecting the dots between food, health, and agriculture. Also, we'll feature a piece from The Food Sleuth. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved when you go to kboo.fm, kboo.fm, and click where it says donate. You can become a member there, and we appreciate that. And now, Making Contact.
I'm RJ Lozada, and this is Making Contact.
We believe in art because we believe in life, in all its variations and all of its beauty. We're here because we also believe that the ugliness, the violence of inhumanity can be transformed. We're here today because we believe that art and culture change things, that cultural change might even precede, might even make political change. To believe in the arts is sometimes having a kind of a faith, not necessarily a religious faith, but very near to it, right? That sometimes things are just gonna be all right. Can't tell you why, right? Can't tell you how. It's gonna be all right though, right? And yet we also know that throughout history, arts and culture have led to revolutions. And so we can talk about the ways in which the arts and culture have brought about revolutions of seeing and being.
We present historian Jeff Chang and his keynote speech at the Art and Race Conference at Impact Hub in Oakland that took place earlier this summer. Chang talks about the importance and value of creating art that provokes viewers from stasis, art that speaks to and responds to struggle, to encourage conversations and build empathy, and more importantly, drive communities into action to create new realities that are inclusive, equitable, and just. And now, Jeff Chang.
Good morning. How's everybody doing? Let's begin by invoking those who came before us, on whose shoulders we stand, and also those who are not yet here, for whom we are working, right? We know that we live in a moment of crisis. We know that things feel as if they're falling apart. And yet, here we all are, together. And what we do is important. We're living in serious times. Hatred has been given free rein against us. Violence has been made acceptable. Violence against us has been made acceptable. Provocateurs, they drape themselves in these flags of free speech to come to our towns and mock our values of openness, of inclusion, to turn our towns into spectacles of division. From Portland to Maryland, the death toll seems to be rising. And so in this kind of a moment, we can't stand on the fence. We can't sit on the fence. We have to take a stand. We can't be bystanders. And in this moment, privilege shows up as disengagement, right? In the refusal to take a stand, in the refusal to show up, as in, I refuse to see how anti-black racism gives me privilege. As in, I refuse to see the inhumanity of a system that leaves so many homeless and unsheltered. As in, I refuse to see the humanity of the refugee or the migrant. As in, I refuse to acknowledge the ways that state violence is inflicted on blacks' bodies, on women's bodies, on queer bodies, on Muslim bodies, on poor bodies. As in, I refuse to treat the bounty of the land, the air, the water, as the kuleana of all, right? As the right and responsibility of all, but instead as a scarcity that I need to hoard for myself. As in, I refuse to join the rest of the world to stop global warming, but I might reserve the right to go see the glaciers before they're gone, or to visit a Pacific hideaway before it's underwater, right? Privilege is the choice to isolate, to draw the line, to build the wall, to say that all that matters is my solitary sovereignty and what I can accumulate before death claims me, right? And so as artists, as people in community, we have to choose in this moment. Art reflects the ways, the infinite ways that we navigate through our lives, right? It's about finding feelings in all of the ways that we experience ourselves, each other, and our world. And so we choose. We choose to stand against the machines of domination, of violence, of death. Against the machines that breed isolation and division between us and among us. We choose to engage. We choose to protect life, to shelter life, to embrace life. And we're all here today because we believe in this, right? We believe in art, right? We believe in art because we believe in life, in all its variations and all of its beauty. We're here because we also believe that the ugliness, the violence of inhumanity can be transformed. We're here today because we believe that art and culture change things, that cultural change might even precede, might even make political change, right? We listen for the rhythm changes. In fact, every day we wake up to make those rhythms change, right? And so we have our doubts. We have our doubts when we're asked, what are we actually doing to change things, right? Is it possible to describe the actual difference that you're making? Can you quantify what you've done? Can you graph it? Can you chart it? Can you show how you've actually moved hearts, changed the soul of community? To believe in the arts is sometimes having a kind of a faith, not necessarily a religious faith, but very near to it, right? That sometimes things are just gonna be all right. Can't tell you why, right? Can't tell you how. It's gonna be all right though, right? And yet we also know that throughout history, arts and culture have led to revolutions. And so we can talk about the ways in which the arts and culture have brought about revolutions of seeing and being. And we can start at any point in history for examples, but let's just start here. in the mid-1960s with the artists of Spiral, and this artist, Norman Lewis. And these are artists who are inspired by the civil rights movement to take a stand and imagine new forms of consciousness that then lead to the creation of the Black Arts Movement, which intersects and also helps to inspire the Chicano Arts Movement, the rise of the American Indian Movement, the Asian American Movement, women, queers, to begin to rethink their identities, their selves, their communities. And then it's still the greatest story ever told, right? How abandoned, forgotten youths of African descent, African American, Puerto Rican kids, came together in the Bronx and other neighborhoods in New York City, built from the ruins of civil society, a cultural movement that still gives voice to millions and millions of people today. And at about the same time that hip-hop is being born, the multiculturalism movement is being announced right here in the Bay Area by Ishmael Reed and his colleagues, the men and the women who make up the Yardbird Collective, who say that the U.S. has never been monocultural, it's never been white. Right? James Baldwin said this as well, right? That it's been shaped by all of its peoples, that this is in fact nothing to fear, that it's just a consciousness shift to be able to make. But if fear is what you must do, then as Flavor Flav says, maybe a decade plus later, right? Armageddon's already here, it's already in effect, go get a late pass. So these were revolutions of being. And so by the end of the 1970s, Toni Cade Bambara had coined a motto of sorts for the movement. She said, the artist's responsibility is to make the revolution, this revolution, irresistible. And there was another idea here, right? One that's become much more difficult to manifest and that we still struggle with. The idea was simply that if we could learn to see each other, we might develop empathy for each other, and from that, we might move to a more just society. Learning to see difference might be the beginning of empathy, which itself produces the possibility of community. But as we get older, humans sometimes begin to attach meaning to difference, which are not so neutral. Notions of superiority and inferiority, right? And then we become aware of how difference has been sorted into these vast systems of freedom, of slavery, of commitment and neglect, of investment and abandonment, of mobility and containment. But then rather than confront those systems, some might choose to draw a veil over these systems, pretend that they don't even exist. And so racism is supported by a specific kind of refusal. It's a denial of empathy. It's a mass-willed blindness. And this is how inequity comes to be reproduced in each generation. And inequity shows up in three ways, right? In representation, in access, and in power. So representation on the stage and in front of the camera, but also a seat at the table. Access to institutions of power and advancement, but also access to the traditions and the ways and the practices that have helped us over the generations to survive. Power to raise one's voice, yes, but also the power to make decisions. So representation, access, and power show up as distributed unequally. And inequity remains with us. It hides within our scope of vision, but too many remain blind to it. And so here's where art may become a remedy, where it might allow us to be able to see again, to close the gaps again. In its mimicry of life, great art helps us to close the distance between the self and the other. It helps us to come together. Another way to say this is that through art, we learn once again how to experience empathy. And yet, what we've seen over the past half century, the same period in which all of these revolutions of being and seeing were in motion, is a reality of growing inequality and resegregation. If there's anything that we've been taught, it's that empathy is not enough. We also need to act, we need to react. And so these revolutions of being and seeing are incomplete. And if we take revolution not as an end, but as a process, right? Maybe they always have to be incomplete. And yet what we know is we're so far from where we need to be. And so we could start here with young Americans, who demographers say are the most diverse generation that America's ever seen. and yet they've come of age in a resegregating country. And we could talk about that happening right here in the Bay Area, right? One of the biggest discussions has been over gentrification, and we're the ground zero for that. And what we've seen over the past two decades has been galloping inequality. And so here's the racial income gap now, right, between white and black median households. Displacement, of course, is a story behind those numbers, but it's more than just that, right? The people who are displaced have to go somewhere, and so Oakland is now the fifth highest rental market in the country. In the country. Boston, DC, San Francisco, New York, Oakland, right? And so people who are displaced, they have to go somewhere, and the domino effect of this displacement keeps on going. And so folks are forced to move further and further out. And so we've seen a lot of our neighbors, our friends, move to Antioch, move to Oakley, move to Stockton, move to Tracy, right? Move out of the area, right? The number of those unsheltered in Oakland has grown 25% in the last year alone. And so that's why the term gentrification is too small for this moment. Gentrification centers the wealth that's moving into the city, but it disappears the people who are moving and forced out, who are displaced, whether to under the highways or to the valley. And all of this boils down to the fundamental question of life expectancy. What we know is that a non-Hispanic black man can expect to live 7 years less than the average American. This is why Black Lives Matter. So again, the questions arise, what can art and culture do in this particular moment? In 1952, Ralph Ellison described the condition that black people face as one of invisibility. And this is what it's been, of course, for people of color, for marginalized folks, for many, many years. But now, in the years after Obama, it's clear that we've also reached a point in history where people of color are hyper-visible, right? So Ellison was also prescient as well when he was writing these words in 1952, right? He also wrote, "When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves are figments of their imagination, indeed everything and anything except me." So the kinds of images that preceded Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and Renisha McBride and Rakia Boyd, Alex Nieto, and so many more. "When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves are figments of their imagination, indeed everything and anything except me." And so the movement for Black Lives has reminded us that the way out of this cycle of crisis, this historical cycle of crisis, right, 1965, 1992 to now, the way out of this is to be able to begin to see each other in our full humanity, to find and feel that we are all connected, to move beyond empathy to action. Empathy is empty. Empathy is empty without action.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Making Contact. We're presenting a keynote speech by Jeff Chang at the Art and Race Conference in Oakland. If you're interested in learning more about this broadcast and others in our archives, please visit radioproject.org. And now, back to Jeff Chang.
And so what can a piece of art do? Like our original's posters here, right? How do we measure what it is that art does? And so perhaps the way to start is by measuring what it means not to make art, right? Not to engage in culture, to let the status quo continue. And to do that would be to let the systems that reproduce inequality and racism and sexism and homophobia, that do the greatest harm to those least able to shield themselves, that rely upon the violence to be able to sustain themselves, right? To let that go. And these are systems of accumulation and alienation that separate us from each other, that take life not as something to be nurtured and protected, but as a zero-sum game in which the winners take all and the losers get none. And so lately in the news, there's been a lot of talk about these doomsday bunkers, right, for the extremely rich. These are people who have accumulated so much wealth that they don't know what to do with it, except for the fear that they've also accumulated, right? For years, they've said to themselves, "I made this," without taking into account any of the other labor, all of the other labor, that allowed them to be able to do that, right? They don't think that they owe anything to anybody. And so now they talk amongst themselves about these uprisings in which the people, and it's always those people over there, in which the people rise up against them in this massive act of vengeance and rage. And perhaps the saddest thing is what this way of thinking reveals about them. That they find it so hard to imagine generosity, they can't see it at all in the world, right? And so that's probably what it's meant when folks say it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And so the obscenely wealthy have take these missile silos, right, and repurpose them into bunkers where they can protect themselves from society, right? It's the ultimate escape hatch. It's complete with simulated exterior windows, right, with pools, with dog parks. It's a logical conclusion of capitalism, a complete and total withdrawal from the social, from almost every kind of responsibility and tie, from engagement and from faith. So the artist's task, our task, is to move ourselves and the rest of us in the opposite direction, toward more engagement, toward stronger ethics, toward a social that's open and inclusive to all, toward seeing each other in full, to challenge us to recognize the debts, and yes, the reparations, that we owe to each other and how they need to be repaid. The artist needs to challenge the logic of blind accumulation, to call out the way that race has been used as a wedge between communities and identities, and also the way that race is now supporting the systems that divide us into categories of those deemed worthy to live and those deemed unworthy to live. In recent years, we've heard a lot about the role that artists have come to play, either willingly or naively, in real estate development. Let's talk about that a little bit, right? A lot of times the story is triumphal. It's a victory for the creative class. Artists made the place cool, and suddenly the area gets all the restaurants and grocery stores and Starbucks that it always wanted, supposedly, right? Property values go up, and the conditions are right for the creative class to come in. But all too often, the result leaves the communities bereft of the people whose creativity, right, and collective effort formed and sustained and made those communities attractive in the first place. They had formed ways, they had told each other stories, they had passed on traditions, they had cultural practices in that place. There was a creative community there already. The creative ecosystem was destroyed. And so these days, it seems every city wants to become a creative city, right? One that celebrates its artists and culture makers, one that features a rich and robust creative class, right? And neoliberalism fetishizes creativity, even as it dictates that creativity is meant largely to entertain those who can afford it, right? And so the cities have welcomed the arts, welcomed culture, and buyers have taken notice, and developers have taken notice. But it's also increased pressures on the longstanding communities there, right? And it's happened across the country, from Miami's Wynwood District to Boyle Heights in Los Angeles, where just as the neighborhoods have become recognized as hubs of creativity, they've also seen the displacement of many of the longtime residents. And so communities are complex, living, breathing things. They're built upon interdependence. They're human ecosystems. Diversity and difference actually increase a community's sustainability, their adaptability, their creativity. What makes gentrification and resegregation so deadly is that it uproots these complex systems. It scatters the people who make them. And for those who are displaced, Mindy Thompson Fully Love describes a sense of trauma that results. And she calls it root shock. It's the loss of difference, of connections, of ways, of traditions, of stories, of practices that people form when they make and sustain a community. And so it's not just the loss of a place. It's the feeling of walking down the street and not seeing the barbershop you used to go to, right? Or your friends down on the corner, right? It's all of those things. And it leaves one with a sense of trauma, a physical feeling. From the beginning of time, we as artists, we've needed patronage, right? And yet, especially in this moment, it's crucial for us to stay focused on the ethics of art making. We have a place where we stand between capitalists and community. And so we're called upon to make choices, to articulate clearly what our commitments are, what our engagements are going to be, what ends we're working towards. And so in this era of rampant development, of rising homelessness, artists should be building projects that engage community in the ways that organizers have long engaged them, with humility, with big ears, with bigger imagination. Arts institutions should be orienting themselves away from being bastions of exclusivity and elitism and toward being catalytic engines for community building, for community learning, for community celebration. And we all should be insisting that local government and developers engage with the local communities, not merely to extract and exploit them, but to provide more affordable housing, more power to shape the transformation of their neighborhoods to the people who are in them. So I work at a university, a small university in the South Bay. That's why I'm wearing all blue today. It's in the heart of Silicon Valley, and not far from there is a town that Anika was talking about earlier, East Palo Alto. It's a small city of 29,000 people. And the median income in East Palo Alto is half what it is in the surrounding Silicon Valley area, right? Its poverty rate is more than double. Some people look at this community and they say, well, it's a cultural desert, right? There's no concert halls there. There's no symphonies there. There's no museum. But they'd be wrong. East Palo Alto has had a long, proud history of arts and culture making. And there's an organization there called the Mural Music and Arts Project that we've been working with for years. It started in 2001. That's educated and employed generations of young people in hip-hop, in the arts, in mural making, in music, in dance, in video. Back then, there was a different kind of displacement that was going on. Drug dealers would come to East Palo Alto from other parts of the Bay Area to try to sell drugs in East Palo Alto's parks. But the youth decided to go into the parks and ask the dealers to leave. And then they put up these beautiful murals, and they transformed the parks back into places where kids could play and families could hang out again. And so their work has helped to stabilize thousands more youths over the years. And in extension, a community that's been under pressure. So East Palo Alto looks today like what some folks call a naturally occurring cultural district, right? It has all the signs of a rich and wonderful and lively arts ecosystem. The downside, as Anika was talking about, is that Facebook set its campus down, not very far, on the Menlo Park side of University Avenue, right? And so now East Palo Alto is in big danger of being gentrified. And so we face the possibility of resegregation once again. But the other possibility could be the strengthening and transforming of community. So art leads to empathy. It inflames the imagination. And we need the imagination to be able to see through and past our blindnesses. We've got to be able to see each other, right? Imagine what we can do together to increase representation, access, and power. And this is the real beginning of transformation and community. And so this brings us back to the person who I always come back to, Grace Lee Boggs, and her thinking about the idea of revolution. And she argued that revolution is not as we think of it, as something to be won in bloodshed, in which there's a replacing of one group in power with another group in power. She said that the next revolution might be better thought of as advancing humankind to a new stage of consciousness, creativity, and social and political responsibility. And so her revolution will require us to move away from finding new ways to divide and rule, to consign some to death, and instead pivot all of us towards life, to honor and transform our relationships to each other and ourselves. She insists that we rethink how we see each other, how we choose to be and to be together. And so we have to move then beyond empathy towards mutuality, beyond relationships that are about exploitation and extraction, towards relationships that are about exchange and support and generosity and trust, that we start from truly seeing each other and move towards acting for each other, past resistance into transformation. How does one measure the effectiveness of the arts or culture? For those of us who believe in justice, in equity, in freedom, it's always going to be our special burden to explore and advance new imaginations that arouse desires for change. Right? We live in a country that's haunted by a history of racial injustice and inequality. The weight of history is always stacked against us. All that the forces of reaction have to do, all that the folks on the other side have to do, is reappropriate our imaginations to reinforce the status quo, and they're doing that all the time. And so our constant struggle is to overcome that kind of stasis. And that requires us to move, to seduce, to inspire people, to manifest ideas of a nation and a world that's still yet to be, to make the revolution irresistible. And so luckily as artists, right, this is where we feel the most at home. Art, as many people have said, is a gift, right? It's something that works at the level of exchange. And it, at its best, it continues to give long after the act of making it and sharing it has passed. It's the gift that continues to give. It's the epitome of generosity. And no wonder its impact is so hard to measure. How do you fix a value on something whose exchange value multiplies across geographies and across generations? And so here's the artist, the Bay Area artist, Ana Teresa Fernandez. She's on the beach at the border in Tijuana, right, on the Mexico side, the border that separates Tijuana from San Diego. And her gift allows us to see what cannot then be unseen. What cannot then be unseen. It offers us the possibility that we might find better ways to be and to be together. And so may all of our work do the same. May it continue to multiply so that our revolution becomes the world's. Thank you very much for listening today.
On today's episode, we bring you a special broadcast and present you two Making Contact Storytelling Fellows, Vincent Medina and Isabella Zizi. They're building upon the traditions and the work of their elders for themselves and the next generations. The Ohlone are the first peoples of the Bay Area, covering areas from the coastline along San Francisco to as far inland as Salinas Valley. After near eradication, the Ohlone were all but completely eliminated and enveloped within the colonizers' world, their languages and cultures criminalized and swallowed up. It would be several generations before the Ohlone would be able to regenerate and reclaim fractions of land rightfully theirs. Making Contact Community Storytelling Fellow Vincent Medina is part of the current generation of Ohlone that are deeply invested in language and cultural revitalization. Whether paying homage to Coyote Hills Park in Fremont or teaching Chochenyo language courses at Mission San Jose, Vincent finds firm footing in his deep-running roots.
Uyakish rote mak warep tak rote payanhit kanakshe. Aye payanhit kanakshe amashmite ya payan muekma aloni. Imhen truhi toekshek ma watin makruaitka aye kikne mak wetrish payanhit kanakshe ya watin. Makwetrish kikne mayan.
Our language almost vanished from the earth. In 1921, in the midst of this tragedy, an elderly woman living in the deep brown canyons of Sinol, named Angela de los Colos, proclaimed with defiance, "Kana akwe tak yuwa tak nanwente." As for me, I am not going to stop speaking. She, along with the also aging Jose Guzman, worked frantically to record, speak, and protect Chochenyo, the language spoken in the East Bay since time immemorial, which was on the brink of death, the precipice of never being used again. What a world that must have been. I can only imagine, but my heart begins to ache at the thought. These people, my elders, my heroes, they made a conscious decision to keep speaking Chochenyo and to fight against time as though in the defiance of gravity. They knew they were the only ones who could protect our language, and they lunged, ducked, and leapt over the hurdles of reality in order to keep the flicker of light from moving into ashes and darkness. Angela and Jose, they weren't going out without a fight. Yellow parchment papers became full of frantic scribbles, an outpour of heartbreak, family histories, gossip, lore, loss and victories, and stories that stretch back to the very beginning of time, described with such an intimacy and an immediacy that they seem to have happened yesterday. Tales of a time when giants roamed the East Bay, when Coyote left his footprints embedded in the earth, when hills and spirits had emotions and proper names, when bodies of stone were defeated in the underworlds, and when songs were sung just about Mount Diablo and Mission Peak. Don't forget this, I picture them telling us. Don't give up on this. Now, right now, let's read these words together, okay? Just so we can get the pronunciation. So for day, Truhi.
Truhi.
No, try again. Truhi.
Truhi.
Try it with your tongue a little bit further back in your throat. Truhi.
Truhi.
He'e. Orshe. Rakat.
Rakat.
Say it a little bit longer. Rakat.
Rakat. My name is Gabriel Medina and I'm 13 years old. I've been learning around 2 years. It's like a secret language. I was in fourth grade and we were doing a mission project and we were learning about Native American Indians, and I told my teacher that I was Native American, and she said that I wasn't because I didn't look Native American, and she knows what a Native American looks like. It's her opinion. I know that I am, though.
I realized just the sounds of the language were something incredible on its own. Being able to connect those old sounds to places here in the East Bay, you could hear the land in the language itself. You know, wherever you're at here in this place, you can often just see like those drops and rises and falls that make the Bay Area what it is, and that's so embedded within our language. It helped me connect in a way to my ancestors that just the words strictly on their own might not. There's context that's there. It tells people who are related. It tells the conditions that people had to go through. It tells the experiences that people had and how people consistently survived and adapted to the changes around them and kept intact what they could in order to keep their culture strong and alive. And when I would read that and connect that with the words, connect that with living in my land, and the fact that Gabriel and myself, you know, two brothers, we both were born in our traditional village. We're meant to be in our homeland. We're meant to be speaking this language. Our elders, they're our guiding forces in many ways. They are linked to the old world that our ancestors lived in. When you go to the language, because I know that you've been to one of the language classes that we had here, when you use some of the Chochenyo words, how does it make you feel when you use them?
Oh, I feel that I'm not saying them properly.
You know what? Surprisingly, and I talked about this with one of the professors that I have at UC Berkeley that I work with. And out of everybody, when we were having that class that first time, you got the pronunciation the closest to the way that I hear the old people say it in the recordings.
Oh, really?
And it was because I think that you probably heard stuff growing up. So somewhere back there in your mind, it's still there. But when you would get the sounds, there's a sounds that I can't get when I pronounce things that you... Well, Aunt Dottie, in many ways, she's like the matriarch of our family.
It must be because you heard it growing up.
Probably so. Mm-hmm. You know, some words stick and some words don't. And some words you can't get them out.
Yeah.
You know, as hard as you try.
She's a tough lady. She's a strong lady. And she's always been somebody who's carried culture forward for us. She's always, and throughout her life, found ways to protect our identity. And she's always found ways to make sure that those who are around are proud to be Ohlone. In the 1960s, Aunt Dottie was the one who led our cemetery being saved near Mission San Jose.
Well, the only person that I ever heard speak the language would be Uncle Dadio. And there were some other family members that came from Livermore that also spoke the language. But to say that I ever remembered what they said, you know, I couldn't repeat it because I don't know the language.
She listened to the old-timers who lived on the old Sonol Rancheria and listened to them speak the language, listened to them tell the old stories that stretch back to the very beginning.
Proud of, yourself that has taken it up. You've taken this upon yourself to be able to teach the younger people the language, which is something that we never had, you know, only bits and pieces now and then, but nothing that ever stuck to us because we were too busy with other thoughts.
Yeah, I understand.
You know.
Kathy, she's a really unique person because she's able to know a whole lot about the old ways. And Kathy also has a lot of insight about my great-grandmother, Mary Archuleta, who, for a brief time while she was in college, she lived with her in the 1970s. When I spoke with Kathy, Kathy was telling me that she could remember hearing our language spoken all the way into the 1950s. She could remember her mother, Maggie Peanuts, and my great-grandmother standing around, and she could hear the language. I just remember thinking to myself how much pride and how excited I felt to know that my great-grandmother, somebody who held me in her arms, that she might have been a speaker of our language in her younger years.
There we go. Okay, so basically I just wanted to ask you a few questions just about Nana, and especially what she was like in your younger years when you were visiting, when you lived with her. One thing I always wondered about, especially with Nana, because I know that she spent time in the orphanage at the mission, and I know that her mom, Victoria Marine, passed away when she was very young over in Sonol. And the stories that I hear from my grandma about this was that things got really hard when she entered the orphanage, where she was separated from her sister, Flora. And there was obviously some really rough things that happened. But I wondered, especially because when I was a kid, Nana was always so proud to be Indian. She was always so proud about who she was, and she would always tell us, you know, that we're Ohlone. And I wonder how she was able to carry on all of that pride in her culture, even with the things that she had to go through that were painful. And
she was a lot like my grandmother, Erolinda. Yeah. The both of them were in Maggie Juarez and Pete Juarez's house. They were living with them, okay? Evidently, they must have, my great-great aunt, I guess she would be my great-great aunt, Maggie Peanuts. I get what they called her Peanuts, but it was Maggie Juarez. She's the one that took them, I believe, out of the orphanage. And I guess because your Nana was chosen and not the rest of them, that may have caused, you know, the conflict or the bad feelings, you know. But they used to get called to for the meat, the buffalo meat, okay. And when every year when they would get called, she would make the calls to everybody, and we were one of the families. We'd all get together and we'd go to Ohlone Park, and we would all celebrate. We'd all be dancing. Mike loved to dance. Your Nana made all of his regalia, all of his clothing, okay? My sister Margaret is your Nana's godmother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
So that's how close we were, you know? And your Nana would make things and give it to my sister because that was her godchild.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Did, with Nana, so you could remember that there was times though that Erolinda and Maggie Peanuts, they would speak the language, right?
Yeah. Can you kind of keep them guys quiet?
There were birds that were very loud in the background. And I remember when I would go to see my great-grandmother as a child, there would be birds that would always be everywhere in her house. And
the same birds were in Kathy's as well. Oh, glorious fighters, stubborn ancestors, people of defiance, people of wisdom, gravity breakers. Today, as a result of your refusal to surrender our language, we can speak the words yet again. Because of those scribbles on parchment paper, our land hears Chochenyo a second time. It's been inside of us all along. The words, they caress us like a loving grandmother's embrace. They comfort us like an old familiar song, and they bring us dignity by connecting us to our ancestors. They connect us to the East Bay, Makruaitka, our home, Makperetka, our land, the place that we love, the place that those before us fought so hard to stay in, the place that we originate from. My elders, my heroes, you saved our language from ever being forgotten, and we will not relinquish Chochenyo, for it thrives in the footsteps of giants. Orshatru hi hem menya, kanakra kat vince medina, ayanesem tahi, making contact.
In a moment, we'll look at how the biocultural diversity of an area depends on people connecting with their language and traditions, along with protecting their land, air, and water. But first, let me explain that Making Contact's Community Storytelling Fellowships are a labor of love. Our producers work hard, hand in hand with the fellows, and the learning goes both ways. The producers share their skills, and the fellows share their wisdom and life experiences. The fellowships are a 10-week paid immersion in the designing, recording, and writing of a radio piece. Fellows we've worked with range from a man who returned home after 31 years in prison to a woman working through the domestic abuse she suffered by reporting on the activism of younger women against violence. You can listen to all of our fellows' pieces on our website at radioproject.org. Our work at Making Contact is listener-supported. No corporate or government funding. We rely on you, so please go to our website to see the ways to help us continue the fellowships. Tell us what you think about these radio pieces. Drop us an email, makingcontact@radioproject.org, or hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Our next community storytelling fellow is an environmental and indigenous leader, Isabella Zizi. In this piece, Zizi talks about how the 2012 Chevron refinery fire in Richmond, California, sparked her involvement in indigenous-led environmental movements, showing us what it's like living next door to an oil refinery and how these towns have come together to protect the sacred systems of the planet.
It's honestly bringing back some memories. It might be triggering for me when I really explain how the day went. It was a really beautiful day. There was no clouds. The sky was just blue. The sun was up and shining, and it was beautiful enough for all of my family and a bunch of my neighbors to be outside just enjoying company. All of a sudden, I had noticed just this instance of darkness. And I had asked my mom, I was like, what is that? And so she turned around really quickly and she did this really big gasp. Like, you know, we all just didn't know what happened. And so She immediately said, "That chevron that just exploded."
Hey, Chevron.
Hello, we have a fire in our process unit.
At that moment, none of us knew what to do. You know, we just see this big roar of a black cloud just shoot straight up in the air. You know, with multiple big clouds following it. And, you know, we heard these booms, these really loud booms. I think it was like two or three of them. And we immediately started to tell everyone, get inside.
Approximately 6:35, there was an explosion of some type at the Chevron refinery in Richmond.
And, you know, just watching it from my windows, just see the clouds just continue to cover the sky and the flares just shoot up. And now people like me who remember that day, I have to fear every day. Am I going to see another explosion in my lifetime? I really hope not. You see, I grew up near the Chevron Richmond refinery in California. In 2012, a ruptured pipe at the refinery caused the fire, sending black smoke into the surrounding areas. It took more than 4 hours to bring the fire under control. Richmond lies in what's known as the Refinery Corridor. There are 5 petroleum refineries along the north coast of the East Bay, less than 30 miles from each other. So those of us who live along this oil artery are all too familiar with the trends of having a petroleum processing plant as our neighbor.
That was the biggest flare I have ever witnessed.
That's Daniel Liddell. He lives in Benicia. That's in the refinery corridor too. Flaring is a process that typically burns off excess hydrocarbon gases or pressure.
It was a really windy day, and most of the smoke coming out of the refinery was blowing northeast away from where most of the residents live, so we were very lucky.
On May 5th, 2017, the Valero refinery in Benicia started flaring at about 6:40 a.m. The EPA found toxic gases, such as hydrogen sulfide, peaking at more than 10 times the normal for the area. The Bay Area Air Quality Management District has launched an investigation, and the Valero refinery was issued 4 notices of violations. I met Daniel a few years ago at the refinery healing walks. These are walks led by Native Americans in prayer from one refinery town to the next.
As we looked around our communities, many of us live in Richmond and other refinery towns, and we really started taking a bigger look at what it looked like, what it felt like, what the health impacts were and the emotional impacts were of living in refinery towns along the refinery corridor.
Allison Ihara Brown is a member of the Mohawk and Seneca tribes. She's a longtime Richmond resident who also helped envision the refinery healing walks in 2014.
Coming together both in terms of our indigenous values around the land and the water and the air and all of life being sacred, and also the concrete experiences of having refineries that would explode and put out flares and emissions. It's been a long period of time for all of us, I think, of really struggling to have independent towns in the midst of a gigantic worldwide corporate industry that wields tremendous power and has tremendous resources to get their way.
Inspired by the tar sands healing walk in Canada, Indigenous grandmothers started the refinery healing walks to walk for clean air, water, and soil. That's what inspired me to get involved. Now, 4 years down the road, our mission to wholeheartedly connect with other community members who live in or around refinery towns like mine is stronger than ever, something Daniel and Allison relate to, too.
Growing up here, I never really felt very isolated living over here. And even though, like, we have our own share of problems, like, the refinery corridor healing walks, they were really the first, it was really the first time that I felt, you know, people were bringing awareness to what was going on in my immediate surroundings. Mm-hmm. And it's just really inspiring to be walking with folks, you know, folks who are walking in commitment to the sacred system of life on our planet.
It feels really different now. It feels like we have a whole movement of people that are united around wanting a healthy, vibrant future for our communities and for our children, where we can see that what we're facing, whether we're in Pittsburgh or Rodeo or Benicia or Richmond, that what we're up against is very similar. And so I think there's a sense of community and community between cities and showing up at each other's struggles in city hall meetings or things like that. That just feels different, I feel. I think none of us feel as isolated as we did before, and we feel more powerful.
Paul, take us away. Hey, 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 yucky.
Refinery healing walks connect the dots between five refinery towns: Pittsburgh, Martinez, Benicia, Rodeo, and Richmond. Every walk starts with a water ceremony where water from different watersheds are gathered together in a pail. Then grandmothers from Idle No More SF Bay lead everyone in prayer. We had just walked past the north gate of the entrance to Shell Refinery here in Martinez. I am in the front with those who are carrying the head staff and the pail of water that we collected from different watersheds. And up here, this is the prayerful part where everyone is in contemplation and in prayer and in song, as you hear in the background the drums and the rattles, to keep our strong presence while we're walking. We are currently walking over the bridge, and there are many walkers who are holding signs that read, "Walk for clean air, clean energy, water is life." There's about 100 people here. Bikers and drivers passing by also shout and honk in support as we walk along. The walk continues on for a few more miles before we reach our final destination in Benicia. A group of smiling faces greet us, high-fiving us as we form our last circle. Then we end our day by creating envisioning squares.
My name is Rich, and we've set these squares of fabrics, so that as people have come off of the walk and have in their mind ideas about a world that could be without fossil fuels, with new kinds of energy, wind, solar, much more understanding and justice and all the other wonderful things that we stand for in this healing walk, that they can express this in some artistic form in these squares.
My name is Donovan. My vision for this walk is empowering the youth and the people around me, the younger audience, like the kids here, being part of this movement where, you know, they're going to grow up and remember that they did something positive, not only for climate, but for themselves, and feel like they've been a part of history.
Sego, Patricia Tano, Ikok Peshni Ichiwi Yunyats. Patricia Sainosh is my name. Well, my vision is that we reimagine the world in the way that it was originally designed to be, and that our relationships reflect that, and our life ways respond to that inclination. We have the map, we have the instructions. So my vision is that we use them and follow them.
People gonna rise like the water. We're gonna calm this crisis down. I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter singing, keep it in the ground.
I envision a world where we are balanced with Mother Earth and use her natural resources rather than abuse or overuse them. I envision life to be free of pollution, imperialism, and destruction of humankind, and that we work together to build a solid platform of sustainable living. These intentions and drawings will be sewn together and turned into a beautiful quilt
that will be displayed in community centers, libraries, and more. The hope is others will be inspired by them too. From Richmond, California, Huchin Ohlone Territory, I'm Isabella Zizi, Northern Cheyenne, Arikaraw, and Muscogee Creek, a Making Contact Community Storytelling Fellow.
And that's it from Making Contact. If you're interested in learning more about the work both Vincent and Isabella are doing, or want to listen to other works produced by Making Contact Storytelling Fellows, you can visit us at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Marie Che, Anita Johnson, Monica Lopez are our producers. Sabine Blazan is our audience engagement manager. And Vera Tykolsker is our development associate. And I'm your host, RJ Lozada. Thanks for listening to
Making Contact here on KBOO Portland. At 10:15 today, we've got Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, The Food Show hosts dietitian Melinda Hemmelgarn, who connects the dots between food, health, and agriculture. And we're going to also feature a piece by The Food Sleuth. Stay tuned for that. But coming up next is Air Cascadia after one announcement. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today. It's 10 o'clock.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.